All right, good evening. I am not Richard. Richard is ill, but he told me that he was at a good stopping point, which is a good thing because we have VBS next week, and then I think we have 4 or 5 weeks in a row of kick off the summer series. So he said I could talk about whatever I wanted to. So I'm taking him up on that. I'm trying to remember now. About a month ago, I filled in for David in class, and then we filled in from him a couple Sundays ago. And in both the lesson and the sermon, I made references to James, and that was probably because I was teaching James to the senior high and junior high on Sunday mornings, and James is one of my favorite books. And it's one of the most studied books in the Bible. And at risk of trying to repeat something that we've studied quite a bit, I find James to be a really good book to study. And as some of you know, it's referred to as the Proverbs of the New Testament. And it's one of the most well-studied books because it deals with a lot of very practical lessons. A lot of the things that James was addressing and dealing with the Christians when he wrote it are things that we deal with today. And I think that's why it's one of the most studied books. And so what I'd like for us to do is just look at James chapter 1 tonight and look at some of the lessons that we can draw from James's letter. And I think you'll find that these are things we deal with today. It talks about how to deal with trials. It talks about how to deal with partiality. It talks about how to think about money. He talks about how temptation works and the warnings around temptation. He talks about how powerful the tongue is and how dangerous the tongue is. And he also talks about being doers, right? Having faithful obedience. And that's those topics he all covers in chapter 1. And the way to think about James is that James, if you were to think about if you can think back to when you were in school and you had to write a paper about something, and in that opening paragraph, you had your thesis statement, and then the rest of your paper, you supported the thesis statement. Think about James that way. What he covers in chapter 1, he will come back and talk about in more detail in chapter 2, and then in chapter 3, and then in chapter 4, and in chapter 5. And so when he talks about the tongue in chapter 1, he comes back to that topic in chapter 3. And when he talks about being doers of the word, he comes back to that topic in chapter 2. And so what I'd encourage you to do as we look at this tonight together, and again, we're only going to look at chapter 1, I'd encourage you tonight or tomorrow to read the rest of James and finish in more detail his thoughts on these topics. And I think you'll find that everything we talk about tonight, he's essentially summarizing it, and he'll give you a lot more details about those topics in the following chapters. Okay, make sense? All right, so let's start in chapter 1, and we're not going to go verse by verse. We're really going to just sort of highlight the topics. I should add that as I was looking over this, I got up and left my office kind of quick and left all my notes. So I need your help tonight to draw on your knowledge of James chapter 1 to help me as we go through these points. But let's start with what I think is always important to start with, which is some context. So we know of different James in the Bible, different individuals who were named James. Who wrote the book of James? Which James? There's two disciples or apostles who were James. All right, the brother of Jesus. But when I think about the brother of Jesus, and I read John chapter 7, verse 5, and I read Matthew chapter 13, verse 55, and I read Mark 6, all of those verses talk about how James, Jesus' brother, didn't believe him. So why would his brother, who didn't believe in Jesus, why would he have written this book? What else do we know about James?
Jesus made a special appearance to him after he was resurrected.
Okay, so in Galatians, Paul refers to James, Jesus' brother, as a pillar of the church. So something happened in James, something happened for James to go from not believing in his brother to then becoming someone who Paul describes as a pillar in the church and someone who wrote the book of James. And it was the resurrection. It was the fact that Jesus appeared to his brother upon resurrection, and apparently that was what motivated him to understand who Jesus was and believe in his brother. So it was, we believe, written by Jesus' brother, stepbrother, James. Does anyone know when it was written? If we thought about James in terms of how it stacks up in the different books in the New Testament, when was this one written?
49.
What? 49 AD. That's very specific. Someone else said it too.
First.
Okay. This was probably the first book written in the New Testament. So put that in context. You know, we sometimes think about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and we go in the order that the books are presented. But this was probably the first book written in the New Testament, right? So this is one of the first letters written to Christians to address issues that they were facing. All right? Let's see. I kind of let the cat out of the bag. Who was it written to? Christians. Christians located where? Okay, I'll come back to that one in just a second. Christians where? Scattered everywhere, okay? So these are Christians who are in various places in the world. They probably were Jewish Christians. The reason why we believe that is, as you read through James, there's a lot of references to individuals in the Old Testament. In chapter 2, you see references to Abraham and Rahab, and there are references to the old law, and so it was likely written to Christians with a Jewish background who revered these individuals or understood who they were. We know anything else about the book of James? Anything else that you're aware of that is interesting about the book of James? Has a lot to say about works. Yep. James is, if you read through James, there's 54 commands in James. Okay, so this is a book that leaves the reader with an expectation of following commands. There's also a lot of parallels here in James to what Jesus taught in the Sermon of the Mount, on the Sermon of the Mount. And if you think about who James was, Jesus' half-brother, that makes sense. And so as we go through the first chapter, I'll just note for you some of the things that James talks about that's not dissimilar from the way Jesus addressed certain issues as well in the Sermon on the Mount. So James begins and refers to himself as a bondservant, which, as you know, a lot of, like Paul often referred to himself as a bondservant of Jesus. What I always find interesting about that when you study James is who's he a bondservant to? His brother, right? So it shows a little bit of humility. I'm not sure I would ever refer to myself as a bondservant of my brother. But James shows his humility, refers to himself as a bondservant. Okay, so let's get into verse 2. And in verse 2, he says, "My brethren, count it all joy if you fall into various trials." Is that what it says? When? What's that mean? They're going to happen. Okay? All right, so he's talking about dealing with trials. And he says, "Count it all joy when, not if, you fall into various trials or tests, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience." Does anyone have a different word there?
Endurance.
Endurance. Okay. So, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, but let patience or endurance have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. So in verse 4 there, that you may be perfect, does anyone have a different word? Mature? Is that what you said? Yeah, mature, okay. So this isn't talking about being perfect like Jesus and never sinning. It means that you're mature and complete. Does anyone have a different word there? All right, it means fully formed, okay? So think about it as that by having endurance, it allows you to be mature and fully formed, lacking nothing. What are these verses, if we just pull ourselves out of these verses, what does this really mean? What's he getting at here? What's the point of talking about why should we count it joy that we face trials? You're learning something. You're on the right path. Because he begins this, and I skip the end of chapter 1. It's greetings, which means rejoice or be happy. Count it all joy when you fall into these trials. We have any runners in the audience? Anyone run? All right. So if you're going to go run a mile or run 5 miles, and you had a time you were targeting, and then you wanted to improve on that, what do you have to do? You have to keep practicing, right? And you keep practicing to do what? To build up what? Endurance. Okay. So the reason you practice running is to get faster so that you can run that mile or the 5 miles or whatever it is you're running quicker, right? You're building up endurance so that you can be better at it. He's saying the same thing here. Count it joy when you fall into trials, because the more times you fall into trials, it helps you build endurance. It helps equip you to better deal with those trials, so that when you have future trials, you're in a better position to manage your way through them. That's the point here, okay? So count it all joy when you fall into trials, because it produces endurance. That endurance allows us to face future trials and get through those trials without falling short. Okay, that's the message from James. Then he goes on to say, if anyone lacks wisdom, let him do what? Okay, so are we left alone to figure out how to manage our way through these trials? We're not, right? So we try to work ourselves through these trials, but we know that we can always ask God. But now when we ask God, we know he will give, it says, all liberally or freely, without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in what? And not what? Without doubting. What's that mean? What's it mean? All right. So you have to have confidence when you pray to him. You have to believe that he's going to address it. You have to have trust that he can address it. And so there is a stipulation when you go and ask for help, you have to believe, you have to have faith that he's going to help you. All right, let's skip down to verse 9. So that's James' advice for dealing with trials. He now addresses really sort of two topics together. So he says in verse 9, let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation, because as a flower of the field, he will pass away. For no sooner has the sun risen with a burning heat that it withers the grass. Its flower falls and its beautiful appearance perishes. So the rich man also will fade away in his pursuits. So he's going to address two different topics related to money. All right, and so in chapter 2, he addresses money. And in chapter 4, he addresses money, but he addressed two different aspects of money. All right, so there's two lessons here. What is James trying to illustrate in these verses that we need to know about money? All right, so you can't take it with you. So just like the flower in the field is going to be burned in the heat and wither away and fall away, so will money. And so where should you put your trust? In God and not money. And so keep this in context, right? He's telling these people that to count it all joy when they face different trials. What are some of the trials that some of them must have been facing? All right, issues with money. So that's the first thing. What's the second thing that this relates to? He talks about the lowly brother glory being let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation, but the rich in his humiliation. What else is he talking about? You. I'm sorry? Okay, so in chapter 2, he talks to them about an issue where individuals are coming into the worship service, and some of them are coming in, and they're clearly rich based on their clothes and the jewelry they're wearing, and then some of them are poor. And what are these Christians doing when the rich people come in? Okay, so they're bringing the rich up to the front and giving them their seats, and they're telling the poor to sit at their feet, right? And so the purpose here is to deal with not showing partiality, right? And to emphasize to them, which he'll talk about in more detail, that in God's eyes, right, everyone's equal. And so, again, he'll talk about that more in chapter 2, and then in chapter 4, he'll talk about putting your trust in riches. So he accomplishes really kind of two topics in those verses. So now we go to verse 12. And it says, blessed is the man, so again, happy or joyful is the man who endures temptation, for he has been approved. He will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Okay, so he talks about, and keep in mind, he's talking to individuals who are facing different trials, and he says to them that you can receive a crown of life, but it's conditional. It's conditional on what? What's it conditional on? Okay, so those who love him and obey him. So he says that you can have a crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. And so you have to love him. And if you love him, you'll have faithful obedience to him, right? And you'll also, because you love him, be able to endure the temptation. So it's conditional. You can get a crown of life, but you have to love him. You have to have faithful obedience, and you have to be able to avoid temptation. And so now he's going to talk about, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. Now, I've read Job, and you've all read Job. How does this line up with what happened in the book of Job? God didn't tempt him. Well, Job lost all his family, he lost all his livestock, he lost all his possessions. Okay, God allowed him to go through temptation. Who was tempting him? All right, Satan. You remember the way the conversation goes with Job? God begins the conversation with Satan and almost sort of trash talks Satan and says, have you considered my servant Job, how great Job is? And Satan goes, well, of course he's good. You've given him all these things. And so what does God say? Well, take him away and we'll see. Job will still be loyal to me. And so Satan takes them all away. And does Job sin? So then what happens? Satan comes back to God and says what? I'm sorry?
God has put a hedge around
him. Yeah. So, sorry, what?
He was faithful to God.
He was faithful to God, and Satan comes back and says, well, he's faithful to you because you put a hedge around him, right? You let me take all his stuff, but you never let me touch him. Because remember, one of the stipulations that God gave Satan was that he couldn't touch Job physically. And so what does God say? All right, well, you can go physically harm him, just don't kill him. And so Satan does that, but Job still doesn't sin. Okay? So there's a difference in being tempted by God and God allowing individuals to be tempted. And so he's saying here, James, is that, hey, when you're going through these trials and when you're going through these temptations, it's not God that's doing it. Okay? God does not tempt you. Now, he may allow you to be tempted, but he's not going to tempt you. And then he says, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. There are two parties involved in temptation. Who are they? The what? The tempter and the temptee. When I was in college, my parents moved to a new house that backed up to this wooded area. And we just moved into the house. I was home from college. And because we had just moved in, all the field mice wanted to find a nice, cozy place to live. And so my parents had mice all in their garage. And I had nothing to do that college, so that year when I was home from college. So I basically became a mouse trapper, all right? And so I would set these traps in the garage. And so when I go to set these traps in the garage, by the way, mice really don't like cheese. That's just in cartoons. If you ever have to trap mice, peanut butter is where to go, okay? So I was putting peanut butter on those mouse traps, and I was putting them all, and I was catching a lot of mice, all right? Who was involved when the mice decided to eat that peanut butter and deal with the consequences of it? There are two parties involved. Who were they? Me and the mice. Okay. All right. I was the tempter, okay? In that scenario, I was the one enticing the mice. So he says in verse 14, each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. So I was tempting the mice with the peanut butter. The mice were drawn away by their own desires. And that's how temptation works. And James is trying to make sure these individuals understand how temptation works. It has nothing to do with God. It has to do with them and the devil, right? And when Jesus was being tempted in the wilderness, how is the devil referred to in Matthew chapter 4? Yeah, that was one of the temptations to give them all the kingdom. But how does Matthew refer to the devil? The tempter. Okay? And so the way temptation works is the tempter, Satan, will do something to try to entice us, and we will either resist that temptation or be subject or fall for that temptation. And if we fall for that temptation, we're falling for that temptation because we're giving in to our desires. Okay? And that's how temptation works. And he wants them to understand how temptation works, because keep in mind, he's writing to individuals who are facing trials and temptations, and he's trying to help them. Yeah, Dan? Yeah. Yeah. And he goes on to kind of talk about that a little bit, Dan, because he says then in verse 15, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death or separation from God. So you're enticed, and now you have a decision. And if you give in to being enticed or lured by Satan, then that desire is conceived, and then it gives birth to sin, and then sin separates you from God. So he is laying out for them the entire way in which temptation works, and it's a warning, right? This is how to think about it so that you can avoid falling into the trap of temptation. Yeah, he's making the point to them that they have no one to blame but themselves. They're the ones that made the decision to be lured away. Now, what are they being lured away by?
Their desires.
Okay. So, what does that tell us about the devil? Okay. I figured out pretty quick, mice don't like cheese. It was just in cartoons. And then I figured out what they did like. So I didn't put any more cheese on those mouse traps. I was putting peanut butter because that's what they desired. That was what I needed to do to lure them. And Satan does the same thing. And what he uses for me is different than what he uses for you and you and you, right? And that's what he wants them to understand. If they're being lured away, if they're being tempted because Satan is smart. He's tempting them with things that he knows that they desire. Make sense? All right. I've wandered too far. Okay. All right, let's skip to verse 19. And you really have to, we have to read 19 with 26. We won't spend a ton of time on this because you all know the lesson here. But he says, so then, or maybe some versions may say, know this, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear and slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Skip down to verse 26 because he kind of continues the thought there. He says, if anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. Okay, so why is it in verse 19 he wants us to be slow to speak? I'm sorry? You won't jump to any conclusions. Okay, what else? Think about what you're going to say. You can do more damage with what you say. All right. What's he say in verse 26? If when we speak, what's it? Where is it coming from? What's it say we're deceiving? Our heart. Okay. So what comes out of the mouth is from the heart. Okay. Now, remember in chapter 3, he talks about the tongue and how powerful the tongue is, and he compares it to what are the three illustrations? The bit of the horse, yeah, the bit in the horse. What's the other one? The rudder of the ship, and the third one? Small fire, okay? And he talks about how dangerous the tongue is. And so he's going to get into those details and talk about how powerful they are, but he wants to make it clear to them they need to be slow to speak, okay? Because if you speak without thinking, you're gonna put yourself in more of an issue with God. And Proverbs is a good book to read when you want to talk about the warnings of the tongue, but he suggests what comes out of the mouth is from the heart. It's really what you're thinking, and so he warns us to be careful with doing that. And okay, let's go to verse 21 through 25. So he says, therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your soul. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man observing his natural face in the mirror. For he observes himself and goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work. This one will be blessed. This one will be blessed in what he does. Okay, so there are two types of people that James talks about. What kinds of people are there? Doers and hearers. Okay, and what are we supposed to be? Doers. Okay, and what are hearers? What do they do? Hear. They hear it and then they walk away and don't do anything. Right, just like a man who goes in front of a mirror, sees himself, and then walks away and forgets what he looks like. So we're to be doers of the word. And of course, this is really sort of foreshadowing the end of chapter 2, where he talks a lot about faith and works that that Robert referred to earlier, right? And the importance of faithful obedience. And so he's explaining to them that they need to be doers. Think back for a moment to the Sermon on the Mount. That starts in Matthew chapter 5. And so Jesus preaches in Matthew chapter 5 and chapter 6 and chapter 7. How does he end the Sermon on the Mount? How does Jesus end that? Anyone know offhand? Okay. So he talks about the wise man and the foolish man. Right, and the kids sing that song in VBS and probably don't realize how important it is. And so Jesus ends the entire Sermon on the Mount with the illustration of the wise man and the foolish man. Right. Okay. And so what is the point? What's the point of that? Why does he bring that up at the very end? What's he saying? He's talked to them about all these different topics in the Sermon on the Mount, and he ends it with the illustration of the wise man and the foolish man. What's the point? Flip over. Let me just read it real quick. Flip over to Matthew chapter 7. We know this story because we think, well, the wise man built his house on the rock and the foolish man built his house on the sand. And the house went splat, right, when the rains descended. But think about these words and how it relates to what we just read. Therefore, verse 24, chapter 7, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rains descended, and the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rains descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. So we refer to these two individuals in here as the wise man and the foolish man. How was James refer to these? Doers and the hearers. Okay? So the doers are the ones who hear what Jesus say and then goes and does them. I would suggest to you, next time you read through the Sermon on the Mount, think about these ending verses to his sermon. His concluding remarks are, you're either a foolish man or a wise man. You either listen to these things I'm teaching you and do them, or you just hear them and don't do them. And you can either be a foolish man or a wise man. So if you go back, and this is just one of the examples that you'll see when you study James, of where there's a pretty close parallel to what James says to what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, so he's imploring these Christians that they need to be not just hearers but doers of the word. Now keep in mind again the context here. These are individuals. This is the first book written to Christians, right? And he's telling them who they're dealing with trials, and he's emphasizing to them that they need to be doers and not hearers, okay? In other words, do what I'm telling you, okay? That's the point he's getting across here. He makes references in verse 21 and then in verse 22 and then in verse 25 to what's referred to in 21 as the implanted word, in verse 22, the word, and then in verse 25, the perfect law, liberty. Those all mean the same thing. What do they mean? The gospel, right? So he's telling them to look to the gospel and be doers of the gospel. And if they do that, then it says at the end of verse 25 that they'll be blessed. Okay, now in verse 26, which how are we doing on time? 2 minutes? Okay, perfect. All right, so verse 26 we already looked at. Let's just look very briefly at verse 27. Pure and undefiled, or uncontaminated and unblemished religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Okay, so if I visit orphans and widows and keep myself unspotted from the world, I'm good. He only listed two things. Is that what that means? All right, there's obviously more to it than that, but it clearly must have been an issue that these Christians needed to hear about. So he's emphasizing to them that they need to take care of the orphans and to take care of the widows. But the ending part of that verse, I think, is a really good conclusion for how he began. He's telling them to count it all joy when they face trials. He's telling them not to get caught up thinking about money. He's telling them how temptation works so that they know how to endure it. Because if you endure it, you get a crown of life. He's telling them to be careful with their tongues. And he's telling them to be doers of the word. And then he wraps it up by saying, you have to keep yourself unspotted from the world. If you want to get to the crown of life, you have to find a way to deal with these trials, to deal with temptation, and not give into it. And if you do that, then you'll truly, in verse 12, then you'll truly love Jesus and receive a crown of life. All right. Okay, thank you for all your attention and participation.